You're listening to the fifth season of Rio Grande's For the Love of Jewelers podcast, a celebration of jewelers, the jewelry community, and the art of jewelry making. In this new season, we're excited to announce that there will be a rotating cast of Rio Grande jewelry tech team members hosting the show. We will share our love and knowledge of jewelry making, along with interviews featuring industry leaders, educators, and fellow jewelers in the community.
Hello, and welcome to the fifth season of For the Love of Jewelers podcast. I'm your host, Pauline Everett, and joining me on the show today is my co-host, Scott Bradford. Scott is a fellow Rio Grande jewelry tech team member who many of you have seen in our tech team videos on YouTube and Instagram. Scott, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, thank you for having me, Pauline. I have been at Rio since August of 2015, so almost 9 years. And I come from the repair and jewelry industry out of Dallas, Texas. Mm-hmm. I graduated from the Texas Institute of Jewelry Technology in Paris, Texas, studying watchmaking, jewelry making, gemology, and CAD/CAM. And then started doing custom bridal work, general custom jewelry, everything that needed to be done in the shop, everything from doing the mold making and cutting to wax injection to casting to CAD design. It's where I learned 3D printing on a solidscape, doing stone setting and just general repairs, retipping, repronging, sizing, anything that needed to be done, really. So my area of expertise is CAD/CAM, 3D printing, and casting, and did a lot of research prior to coming to Rio into casting 3D printed resins, kind of in the early days of those castable resins.
So in your time in the jewelry industry, you've also taught classes locally, haven't you?
Yes.
And so you were doing more of like CAD-centric classes. I mean, I've taken your Rhino courses. Mm-hmm. Always full of puns and very fun. You have to very much be listening to what you're saying to hear the puns that you give us. But
you're welcome.
Yes, thank you. And so a lot of that kind of blends into our next segment with our interviewee, Alicia. She's taught a lot of classes as well, more for wax carving and other things within the industry. But she is a wonderful instructor and has a lot of information and knowledge to share with us. We are excited to have Alicia Goodwin from Lingua Nigra join the show. Alicia is one of my favorite jewelers and an inspiration for other women jewelers looking to get in the jewelry business. Alicia has been featured on Good Morning America, The Kelly Clarkson Show, and Huffington Post, along with many other shows and publications and her own classes. I met her at my first trade show, Snag. We hit it off instantly and she was so kind and welcoming to me and we've kept in touch ever since. Her dedication, talent, and sincerity as a jeweler and an individual are so admirable. She's one of my favorite people that I have met through the jewelry industry. Before we get to our interview with Alicia, we'd like to take some time to answer a few questions that we received from some of our listeners and viewers of this podcast and our Rio Live Tech Team Tuesday streaming show. Tech Team Tuesday is a new weekly streaming show that we stream each Tuesday at 11 a.m. Mountain Standard Time on YouTube and Facebook. On the show, we talk shop and answer questions from our viewers about jewelry making techniques, tools, and tips. What's our first listener question, Scott?
The first question comes from Steve Lawrence. He asks, what is the best way to get a bright shine on gold pieces, rotary tumbler or magnetic?
I think that depends on the piece itself. If you've got a piece with a lot of detail, it's easier to put it into a magnetic pin finisher. But that also depends on what stage of polishing you're at for your actual piece. Because if you throw something into a tumbler and it's got a lot of dings in it, the tumbler's not going to take it out. So if it's like a fresh casting, that might be a little bit easier, but you still need to do more cleanup. If it's just like a plain flat band, nothing with a lot of detail, a rotary tumbler will be better. But again, it depends on where you're finishing in your piece.
Well, I would imagine the level of finish is going to be similar between the two. It's just kind of where it can reach.
Exactly.
You know, and nothing will compare to the high shine of some compound and a buffing wheel.
Yeah. That would be my preferred method. I would rather do like a three-step polishing sequence than throw it into a tumbler, because tumblers are great and they can do mass production really well. But if you spent a lot of time on your piece, you want to spend a lot of time making sure it's at a nice high finish if you were looking for that. Cool. And then our second question comes from Blue Storm on YouTube. She asks, I was told by my metalsmith class teacher that the Smith Silversmith torch is a better choice than the little torch. Is one gas more dangerous than the other, i.e. propane versus acetylene if using indoors?
When it comes to propane versus acetylene, they both have their ups and their downs. Technically, with acetylene, you are going to get, when used with oxygen, you get a hotter flame. Mm-hmm. So things are going to heat up quicker. However, acetylene is considered a dirty gas, so mm-hmm. it does put off some soot when you're using it with oxygen. Propane, on the other hand, is much cleaner. You know, mm-hmm. you don't get that soot, but technically you don't get the high temperatures of something like acetylene and oxygen. My personal preference is propane. However, when it comes to the safety aspect of it, everyone should be aware that with propane tanks, because they're typically designed to be the most common uses with barbecue grills, which are outside. So those tanks actually self-regulate. Mm-hmm. So if it gets too hot outside and pressure starts to build up in the tank, it will actually release a little bit of gas. That gas, being heavier than air, will actually start to build up on the floor. So you do want to be in an area that has some good airflow, if that's the case. But the reality is that if you're indoors, you have a heater on or your AC, so the temperature stays around, you know, 70 degrees or so year round. So, but that is one thing to be aware of.
Well, and then that too, we can't really advise on, like, if you're using propane and oxygen or acetylene and oxygen, if you're using it indoors, how that affects, like, somebody as far as fumes. Right. Probably be best to talk to, like, a primary care physician or talk to, like, an environmental specialist about your specific area, so that way they can give you the best recommendation, because we are not doctors, even though it would be really nice if we were doctors and jewelers, but not enough time in both. So can't really recommend on that. But even with, like, propane is still a vaporous gas too, so you get some buildup on your actual equipment from it. So there, like you said, there's a benefit to both. I use a silversmith at home, but I also have a little torch and a casting torch. So it just kind of depends on the application. I think the silversmith can do a lot, but if you're doing gold, especially really fine gold, propane and oxygen, I find I have better results with and more control with. But I think it's really kind of learned preference. There's not a downside or a benefit to either, in my opinion.
Yeah, and it depends on the piece. I mean, if I'm doing, if I'm going to be, you know, smithing a large cuff bracelet or something, then I'm going to lean more towards the acetylene air,
right?
Because it is a much bigger torch.
Right.
But, you know, if I need to solder on all, you know, make tiny little components or things like that, where I need real precision, then I might go more towards something like the Smith Little with a smaller flame.
Right. Yeah. And it definitely depends on what you're doing. I know a lot of people, especially locally, we kind of have gone with, like, the silversmith torches. But again, I don't think that there's necessarily a good or bad. It just depends on the application. There's a tool for everything. And so making the decision on kind of what you want to go with your pieces will help you kind of lean more towards a decision on flame output or heat output, I think.
And it's convenient. It's one tank,
one regulator, one hose. Yeah, yep. You don't have to worry about flashback arresters with a silversmith system.
Yeah, that's another thing. I mean, it's basically one pressure with mm-hmm. the silversmith torch, and that's going to count for all the tips.
Right.
But then when you get into the Smith Little, you know, there is recommended pressures that are different for each tip and that sort of thing. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you to our listeners for sending in these great questions. Do you have a question you like answered on the show? Send us an email to podcast@riograndecom. And don't forget, be sure to watch Tech Team Tuesdays every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Mountain Time on our YouTube and Facebook pages. Today's episode is sponsored by Lindstrom Tools, founded in 1856. Lindstrom is one of the oldest continuous manufacturers of jewelry tools in the world. Setting the standard in precision tools, Lindstrom strives for perfection, delivering the high performance and long service life their customers have come to expect. Now through the end of April, use code Lindstrom1 at checkout to get 10% off all Lindstrom tools.
So joining our show today is one of my favorite people I've had the pleasure of meeting in the jewelry industry and an inspiration to all women entrepreneurs, Alicia Goodwin. Thanks for joining us. It's so nice to see your face, even though it is virtual.
Hi, y'all. Thank you for having me. It's nice to see you too.
So we kind of wanted to start off with what you are currently working on. We wanted to start off with your processes and kind of how you work. So when you sit down to create a new piece, does that start with pencil and paper, a CAD program, wax, or do you jump directly into metal when you start working?
I am all over the place. I get, even though I'm a Taurus, May 5th, holler Taurus people. I like to do something different every day. And I get bored very easily. I like a routine, but I get bored very easily. That being said, I wish I could pan to the studio because it looks like a tornado just hit a tornado and a hurricane and an earthquake.
That's proper.
Yeah, it's fitting. So
I'm doing a few different things. I'm part of the Radical Jewelry Makeover project. Okay. And so, like, I stayed here until 3. I was supposed to leave at like midnight. I do this, you know. I should just not pay a mortgage and just live here. But I'm working on that. So I was like getting inspired by cutting up this bunny, and then I'm gonna melt this Molly chain. I never had a nameplate, so I thought, oh, that's weird. So I'm just trying to think of things to repurpose for the Radical Jewelry Makeover, and change it up and make it different. But I'm also, I was fulfilling orders, and what else was I doing? I just bought a new wax bench. It's a secretary.
Oh yeah, that like secretary bench that you got. It looks so cool.
It's so good. It's kind of small, but I'm gonna work with it. I got it more for aesthetics than functionality. But once I move stuff over, I think I need to get started. This was supposed to be like my off week, which wasn't. It wasn't. I was sick. So I'm trying to get back into the groove. And but I want to work on wax. The process is very random. Just long story short, my background is in costume jewelry. I worked in the industry forever. And you get used to a formula of doing collections. And I don't work like that. I can't. I'm not disciplined. I have no idea how I'm self-employed. Because you have to get paid. You know, I have to make money. And I force myself to do that by saying I'm going to have so many things done. I'm very goal oriented. So I need things done by a certain date and then I can tease it. But sometimes that tease lasts for a month. It's sometimes it lasts for a year. Sometimes it lasts for 2 years. That's what I do. I'll either start with a sketch and I'll carve it in wax. Most of the time I'll carve it in wax. And then I have a library of reticulated sheets of metal from almost 20 years ago, just when I get the chance to reticulate something or etched metal. And then I'll kind of marry the two depending on what the sketch looks like or how I want the sketch to be. But I like a nice brain bender. I don't use a lot of stones or color in the work. So when I do, it has to be something really special, like the beetle wings, the green.
Yes. I did want to talk about that. I love that you use found objects, but also like things that have a lot of color, but maybe aren't something that you would see like in a normal jewelry store, like a beetle wing.
So I'll use that. Or I have a huge cabinet of stones because I'm a hoarder and I like to buy things.
Solidarity.
You'll never see it again. So yeah, I have a huge cabinet of things. I like to go to Rhode Island. The last time I was there, I went to Wolfie Myro, which is like the Mecca, which, side note, I don't know if you've ever, have y'all ever been to Wolfie Myro?
No, I didn't have a chance when we were in Rhode Island to like tour around.
It's so good, but also a safety hazard. I didn't realize that you go like downstairs and the floor or the ceiling is held up by jacks. Like it's all, I know, I didn't notice that. And the floors are, you know, like 120 years old. So I was like, I could really literally die, like dying for jewelry. I got some really cool bone beads and I just like to buy things and think of the whatever to do later. I usually never have a plan for it. A lot of people do. You will never see me in Tucson because I have no self-control. Right. And also I'm trying to think of new ways, like a costume, the jewelry that I make is not sustainable. I don't try to pretend like it is. So if I could just buy stones that have already been cut from 50, 60 years ago,
right,
instead of, you know, getting new things and then not buying anymore, like making that run out, making it a limited edition, you know, making it one of a kind. I'm trying to go more in that direction, although it's a lot harder because I still want things to be under a certain amount. I don't want things to be, you know, $700, $800, $900. I mean, if I could get away with it, I probably would, but I'm not going to. So.
It's like trying to clean out your fridge.
Right,
you have
right.
To go through everything in your pantry and your fridge and to get through the next thing, but you know, there's always that one craving that you have.
Yeah, and hopefully it sticks. Like back in the day, you would do a collection, you would show at a trade show, and whatever didn't get picked didn't go on the line. Whatever a store didn't pick didn't go on the line. During when the pandemic first began and the show stopped, I was like, oh, I don't have that option anymore. My favorite trade show stopped showing Capsule. It ended right before. And so that's when I started just doing drops and then just adding stuff to my line sheet for wholesale. So it's kind of a reverse, but it's really nice. Like I love everything, but the public opinion helps a lot. And what people think, what I think is popular is very different from what people purchase. And sometimes it doesn't matter how much it costs or the size. I hope that answered your question.
That definitely did. It was a perfect answer.
So you had mentioned costume jewelry. What attracts you to costume jewelry?
Everything. I've been in the industry for over 20 years. We learned a little bit about it. I went to the Fashion Institute of Technology for jewelry. I went for fashion actually and graduated and went across the hall for jewelry. And we this is how old I am. We had a white metal class. I think complete with lead. I'm pretty sure there was lead in our white metal. And we were just carving, and it's so old school and a lot of people don't know about that. And later on when I started to work for other companies like Lee Angel and Rachel Reinhardt and places like that, they would go to Rhode Island makers because there were so many talented people there from just Italy and Cape Verde who were naturals at carving. They didn't carve in wax. They made these models in white metal. And it was a one-to-one and they knew the shrinkage. And it's a whole other school of thought. So that's how I got into it. I just thought it was incredible and really fun. You can make really fun, approachable things that are quasi affordable. I mean, you know, in the greater scheme of things, it's not five figures, it's three figures, it's two figures. Unfortunately, everything's changed a lot. And I mean, it's still a really big industry, but it's like all the companies that I worked for are gone. Two are, but they're hanging on by a thread because all the places that I worked for, they were the middlemen to the bigger stores. And now the bigger stores just go straight to China. But yeah, it's just I just love costume jewelry, and I didn't realize how much I loved it until I transferred into jewelry. I didn't know what I was doing. I just wanted to take jewelry. I did not think it was going to be a career. Not at all.
When it feels like the designs, the designs are so interesting and they're so elaborate in some cases. And yeah, I love the designs of costume jewelry and
Plus, and I think with like the market of like people going like more like thrifting is like a much bigger thing now. You can find more interesting like costume jewelry for a more affordable price. And I think it has this like back to like an attraction to it because it is inexpensive, but it could be vintage. It could be something that somebody's really looking for. And so there is like a resurgence of costume jewelry. And the stigma around it is starting to, especially with like my generation or even younger generations, is starting to kind of fade because it has its own interesting quality to it.
It's wild because it's just there were just so many talented people making this costume jewelry, people who drew and looking at these drawings and then seeing how they were made and the beginning to end. Even like I worked at Juicy and I would draw. That's how I kind of taught myself Illustrator. got myself into a few jobs that way and learned on the job. And then I really learned how to design and draw a lot better in Illustrator at Juicy, just drawing charms all day and listening to podcasts. But that being said, that was a big, Juicy was really big in seeing how popular things were, but also at Lee Angel. I was at Lee Angel and that was a very high-end costume fashion jewelry place. But Juicy, the quality was bananas. And I don't think people know, even the clothes, the quality, no poly. Everything was cotton silk. The jewelry, all Swarovski stones. The plating was IP. So ionic plating. I got to go there. I got to go to the factory. I wasn't working for Juicy at the time, but the ionic plating is like, it's the plating that you use for stainless steel or watches. So it's pretty durable, and it was actual gold, which I was used to. But at the end of my freelancing consulting career, I would ask like how many mils or the thickness of gold I should ask for something. And my boss, who was my friend, she was like, "What? It's just gold." I was like, right. "Oh, it's just a
thing." I don't have an answer for that.
this is not, I can't do this. So it went from like all the way down. It was just like a long, like a, I should go like that. The line is like a stock market crash of the quality, and the stones were like plastic, and the care wasn't there at all. And it wasn't collectible. It was more disposable. So I'm happy that people are kind of getting back to that collectible items. I just want people to be, at the end of the day, I want people to be collectors. And I really appreciate that people are, hopefully, at least the people who purchase my work, understand that it should last for a long time.
Right. And you had mentioned FIT because you'd gone to FIT, but you've taught several courses through FIT Center for Continuing and Professional Studies, like technical design for costume jewelry. What effect has teaching had on the way you design your jewelry or you make your jewelry now?
It doesn't. Teaching makes me horrible anxiety. I get physically ill. I actually stopped because I was getting so sick because I get nervous about people's expectations. And I want everybody that's taking time out of their evening, weeks out, and I want them to have a good class. Also, I spent so much time putting the class together. So yeah, no, it doesn't. I will say teaching it to people who don't know anything about jewelry, sometimes people had to fulfill it for a certificate, like the graphic design certificate, because it's kind of Illustrator 3. I used to teach Illustrator 2, or Illustrator as well. And people who didn't know anything about jewelry, they're like, "What? Wow." One woman, I remember she was like, "Wow, your ears are different. Like your left and your right, or your fingers are different sizes." Like there's just things that people don't think. I know.
That you don't like it, like from an outside perspective, you don't really like think of stuff like that. You don't think of like your foot, one side is bigger than the other, your eyes bigger than the other, your ears, your fingers. Yeah.
So it was interesting to just like jump out of it because I'm so deep in the jewelry world. When I talk to like a non-jewelry person or teach somebody, there're just so many things. And that's, we would joke about this, especially at Lee Angel, because there's a lot of crying in costume jewelry. A lot of tears that people didn't know, you know, this charm that they're going to throw away in maybe 2 months, that how many people cried in the hallway for that or cried in their pillow. I don't know, the teaching, I haven't taught since I've moved. I've been in Chicago for almost six years. I haven't taught at all. I used to teach a lot in New York. It would stress me out. But I like the end result. Some people really got really amazing with it and really took off and were, you know, the whole point of me teaching the technical design classes, I got so inundated with work and I didn't want to turn down money, but right. I had to. And so I just wanted to teach other people like, hey, you could do this and you could make a lot of money an hour and not really have an overhead if you take this class. So it worked out.
I've been reading some articles or interviews that you had been in and some of the videos, and you had mentioned being inspired by the local architecture. And as I recall, you had called out some of the architecture of Chicago. Is that correct? Like Louis Sullivan, that sort of stuff.
Yeah. I love Louis Sullivan. He's probably a favorite because his biggest thing was saying that form follows function. And I try to do that in the work somehow, Like, I like how things are kinetic, but if you are in costume or fashion jewelry, there are a few sayings. No money in the back of the neck. So like if you do castings, if it's really cheap jewelry, it's just gonna be chain and then like one casting. You don't go all the way around. And I forgot the other sayings, but I try to think of that when I make things. I'll try to make things that I can cut away. Like I'll have a casting or I'll make a piece and I want to use it in several different ways, but it needs to look different. It can't look like I'm just using the same casting. Some things I want to look like that, but a lot of things I want it to look very different. I want it to look like there are four different castings on here, but I also know that's going to be a lot of money. Louis Sullivan, even though he died penniless, which I feel like a lot of people I like died penniless. but his work is so noticeable. I know, right? I was up north like last year, and I never noticed that there was a building across the street from this piercing place I would go to. And it was a Louis Sullivan building. And his stuff, you know, his work is just so recognizable. And I walked up to it, I was like, this has to be a Louis Sullivan. And it was. The work is just so intricate and bold and just, oh, it's just so dynamic. It's so beautiful. He's definitely a favorite.
Oh, as soon as I heard that, it's, you know, it's like, yes, finally, someone called out Louis Sullivan. Someone had shown me, there's a chandelier in, I believe it's in a bank in Minnesota. And I mean, it's one of those designs you can just get lost in and, mm-hmm. you know, find something new every time you look at it. But do you find yourself kind of looking towards outside the jewelry industry for inspiration, or do you have some favorite jewelry designers?
A little bit of both. I've noticed since I've been in the, I sound old, I'm like, since I've been in the industry for so long, I try not to look at other jewelers because in the industry, they would just say, oh, look, let's go and knock this person off. Like very unethical things that I was not a part of. I was very much the person against it. There are people that I admire, but I definitely go outside of that. I travel. I actually just booked a ticket to go to DC for two different shows to see two different artists. My favorite artist of all time is Alma Thomas. And she created a brand new technique of painting with all these different dots and dashes and these layers. And it looks like you're looking at a dream sequence and you're trying to look in between these lines and the patterns that she does. And it's just, it's incredible. And she was really prolific and she really didn't become a full-time painter until her 70s, I believe. Mm-hmm. So, but she was painting up until then. She taught children. She had these paper, she did a lot of work in paper. So I traveled to Tennessee to see her work. I'm going to DC. And then when it's in Colorado, I'm going to see the show in Colorado and I'm going to try to harass the museum and see if I can sell my work there too.
Right.
Another favorite is who was a jeweler, but he was a metalsmith. He was in everything is Harry Bertoia. I wish he would have been around or I would have been around when he was around. He seemed like such a very cool person. I've seen his work. I went to Dallas. I think it was Dallas. It was somewhere in Texas. It was a sculpture museum. They had a retrospective. They had his sewn ambient pieces. They had a movie with him. They had his gongs. It was such a gorgeous show. And just a beautiful tribute to his work. And it's just incredible to see people so prolific and who know what, not even who know what they need to do. I guess they found their calling. And they were just allowed to be in it. And then the fact that his jewelry, like he just happened to make jewelry and it, right. you know, these little tiny sculptures. But I stumbled on his work when I saw it. I was like, this looks just like mine. It used to be a bank on Fifth Avenue and it's historic because his work is in there. So they can't tear it down. It's been a retail space for maybe like 20 years. But it's this massive sculpture of reticulated metal. It's beautiful. So I would just go and visit it every now and then, especially if I was in the area. I was consulting around the corner and I would go, it's right near 47th Street, the Diamond District in New York. And I would go and just check it out and just be in awe. And it was behind a cash wrap. So people were like, oh, do you need help? Like, no, I'm just
staring.
Looking. it was the store was Joe Fresh at the time. And then they covered it up. It was the North Face, and they covered it up, which is wild to me. I don't know if they uncovered it, but yeah. And he has a lot of public work, and that's when you delve into somebody like that. He did a lot of private work, but he did a lot of public work, which I feel like that says a lot. You know, like it just says a lot about the person. If you know, I hope he wasn't a jerk. It doesn't seem like he was. I look all over, and I admire so many jewelers, and I have so many jewelry friends. I've been really fortunate to just have a really nice connection, or not nice, but an amazing connection with so many talented people. But I definitely just go outside to see how other people's brains work, and for some reason that inspires me to make more jewelry. Or I don't know, I'm like, wow, these people are really working. Like they're really doing,
they're really putting it out there.
Like, this is wild. I can't wrap my head around that. I can't. Like a whole museum, like it's not just a wall, or it's
just
wild.
A part of an exhibition. It's just a whole thing.
It's a whole museum. Yeah.
And like on that note, so you do use a lot of acid etching and reticulation to achieve texture in your designs. What about that specifically speaks to you and the way that you want to create your pieces around that? Like, obviously, it's interesting that your designs match somebody else who had already been doing reticulation. What about that sparks something in your brain?
So I used to love, well, not used to, but I don't live there anymore, but I would go to the Met all the time because it was free. And I stumbled on the Mesoamerican, like Mexican, Central American jewelry. I was like, oh my goodness, this is incredible. And I feel like it's not highlighted as much as jewelry from Europe and certain times in Asia. And it's just, it's the way the people made these things before there was electricity, before right. so many modern things, not to say that their things weren't modern, you know, people knew zero, right. which was like, that's a big thing. So seeing that, and no offense to Rio, cause I love y'all. I don't need to buy everything. It goes back to like, okay, I don't need this equipment. I could work without doing X, Y, and Z. Obviously, there are things that, you know, it makes it easier for us, but there are things that I have to stop and say, what makes me like this piece of jewelry so much? Look how well it's designed. And somebody just made like a hammer from jade and hammered it out and made these beautiful, intricate pieces without any other... not that much equipment. So I try to think of it that way. When I learned reticulation, I was really broke. I was in college and I didn't have any money for silver. Silver was $4 an ounce. I could not afford that. So I was buying brass. I know, right? Which is weird though, because inflation is about the same. Because it was, yeah, and gold was $400 an ounce. And this was 2002, 2003. I know, but I mean, for perspective, my room was $400. Like my rent was $400. Right. So there was still a lot of money, you know? But yeah, I just learned how to reticulate in brass instead of sterling silver. Every time the professor would say, hey, all right, everybody get some silver. I was like, can I do this in brass? Like some of my classmates were like, Alicia, like, you gotta, like, can I do this in nickel silver? I really like those techniques, learning about beeswax and just wax carving and how ancient that was and lost wax casting. And I use cuttlefish too. I'm going to melt this little chain and cast it in cuttlefish. Just simple, easy techniques, but that aren't, because it's alchemy. So that goes into the process. The reticulation and the acid etching. I mean, I guess the acid etching is, you could still etch in a different way, but I don't use like super crazy techniques. You'll never see me. I'm not going to say it, well, I'm going to say it here. I'm very anti-CAD. I'm sure there's a place for
there's
it.
There's a defined line between people who love it and people who hate CAD. Like, there's like such a thing of like people would rather wax carve and would rather do CAD, but there's like a very definitive line between the two.
There's no hand in it. And that's what I really liked when I came from fashion. And no disrespect to anybody, but with fashion, there's so many people who you never had to learn how to sew. And that was a big thing. There were people who could draw beautifully. And FIT, you have to learn how to do everything. But then our rivals, Parsons and Pratt, you didn't have to do that. It was more expensive. Those are the private schools. I went to public school and they would just hire somebody to do all these things. So right. That's why I love jewelry, like learning about jewelry, like, oh, you needed to have some kind of talent. And I mean, for the most part, you know, you have to have the skill. You have to know how to do that X, Y, and Z. Right. And I feel like CAD kind of cuts it out, but there's just no hand in it. Like there's no hand. There's no imperfection. And it kind of spoils the customer or some like the unknowing eye to see that this is perfection and we're human. You know, I like that right. The left and the right don't look exactly alike. Yeah, it's part of the design. I'm very, it's funny, I'm anti-CAD and I had a whole career consulting and doing stuff on Illustrator.
Well, and it's like that, it's a Japanese like way of like, it's wabi-sabi, right?
Wabi-sabi.
Where the human touch is in something, like you can see a fingerprint, you can see one side is a little bit lower than the other in like a pot. And so it's like, it's something that is very like culturally kind of throughout of like having the human element within something.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I think because everything's just so natural and you know, the work is natural, I just try to not try to overthink things. And because I have such a limited amount of time to create and make new work, as much new work as I want to, some things are rushed and I've just kind of like let it go, you know, like, okay, I don't need to smooth this out. I'm just going to send this to the caster. It is what it is. And it sits well anyway. And the point comes across, you know, no one's like, ooh, this isn't, I mean, maybe they say it. It's because not everybody, right. Don't make me cry at my booth. Yeah.
But it's also like, I feel like that's part of like, especially you talking about like Mesoamerican, I feel like that's part of your design. Like it is like I sent you that picture of those earrings from that TV show however long ago. And I was like, did you kind of make those? Because it almost like fit into your design of how you make things. Mm. But it's funny that you bring up like Mesoamerican and like lost wax casting. That's like my weird special interest is like looking at old techniques of making jewelry, and especially like the Riachi warriors. I'm obsessed with them because they were these huge bronze statues, and I talk about them all the time, but these huge bronze statues that were like cast pieces and they were found at the bottom of the ocean, but it was like 2,000, 3,000 years ago. It's just amazing what a human brain can do with the resources that they have.
Yeah, no, I'm in awe. I just love looking at just what everybody can do. I remember going to Dresden, Germany, mm-hmm. and there was this crazy show, and it was obsessive. It was bananas because it was like all objets. So, you know, this is like when you're really rich, like, let me have a little ship, a miniature 22 karat gold ship.
Right.
Why do you need a ship? Or ivory objets, like these long things that it's one piece of ivory, but it's movable. It has these rings. It's like a thing with rings on it. I mean, it was bananas just to see how people worked. And yeah, it's incredible. It's incredible. I'm always in awe.
So I do have a question. So the rubber ears. What was the story behind the rubber ears, and do you still have them?
Wait, what rubber ears?
You remember the earring display?
Yes.
Do you still have those?
Yes. Where did that come from?
How do you know that?
Yes, I still have them. They're in a tray somewhere. I bought those in 2020 because I didn't think I'd like to do a photo shoot every year with all of my things. I have my favorite model I have a few favorite models, but I have one who's been in almost every campaign. Sada, she's incredible. It's also cool because she was like a baby when I started taking her pictures, and she's like just gotten older. But I use those rubber ears. Those are weird. That's such a weird question.
Oh, I saw them and I loved them. Those were great.
Oh, I can send them to you. They're weird. And
are they squishy? Are they like actually rubbery?
Yeah, no, they're like silicone ears. So I got a whole bunch of silicone ears because at the time my ears were stretched. I stretched my ears in the 90s. And so I had big holes, so I couldn't wear, I couldn't model my own jewelry. But right. Ever since I got them sewn up. And so now I can wear, it's been, I haven't worn earrings like this since high school. So weird. So yeah, sorry, the rubber ears are retired.
So one last question before we let you go, what tool could you not live without?
Well, is a torch really a tool? I guess not.
Yeah,
and that's, sure.
That's a few things, a tool. Though,
it's like the tip, and then you got the little handle, and you got absolutely. The thing, and then you got the maybe the caliper.
That's a good one.
Either my caliper or, and I've had that. I've had a lot of my tools since college. I guess that's a good question.
Gotta think about that one.
Either that or my Joyce Chin shears. That I picked up at Allcraft, all still around, like super OG, and all the books, all the old jewelry books, Allcraft is around. So, two very sharp things. So, one or the other.
Sharp things and measuring things. Well, and I think that's a big thing. Is like we don't realize having like a caliper or like a set of pliers, those are our most used tools, but we always think about like the big fancy expensive things, but calipers are like is so essential for jewelry making.
Yeah, and you can score, you know, if you just have the calipers, you can score on wax with it and on metal if you don't have dividers or anything. So, and it's exact. I like looking at the millimeters. So yeah, maybe that might be it.
I love that. That's such a good answer. I really like that answer. So we're kind of at our time now. Thank you so much for spending even just the 35 minutes with us. I know you're super busy right now, but thank you for spending time with us. And I really love talking to you. I can't wait to see you in Albuquerque soon. So come visit and we'll spend some time together. Love spending time with you. Thanks again to Alicia for joining us today and spending the time to sit down and talk with us. Before we close out the show, I'd like to talk about a tool that I got to play with at MJSA that I hadn't had the chance to look at yet. It's the Agilo Capshine. They are little polishing diamond embedded wheels that there's a lot of different kind of diamond wheels out there, but I got to sit down and use a huge variety of those at the bench that we had at MJSA. And I thought that they had a lot of potential and I could see how I would use them in my own work. And I think that they're a really great, compact, long-lasting diamond tool.
So are you using them on stones or metal or gravers or
kind of a mix of all? So I like to take my old burrs and I like to shape them down into like burnishers or new tools, just because tools are expensive. And also if I've got a broken bit, it's a lot easier to use and make a tool that I need right in that moment than it is to wait for something to get to me. And then I buy a lot of stones locally. And so some cabs kind of show up and they're maybe a little wonky on one side or just kind of not as even as I'd like them to be. So I like to use that to shape down my cabs and kind of get things a little bit more precise. But there's a lot of benefits to those. And I also do some hand push engraving. So I've been using that to kind of brighten up my faces too on my gravers. So they're really good all-purpose little diamond wheels and they have a really large surface area. I don't think they're that expensive at all. So they're just a great thing to have added on to the bench for those specific things. What kind of tools have you been getting into lately? What's new for you?
I finally decided to cash in the shop swear jar and I got a pneumatic engraver and a microscope, taking the plunge to, you know, learning engraving. So I'd always done stone setting and engraving just by hand,
right,
with my optivisor and a loop to check it. But yeah, finally decided to make that big purchase and try to step it up a little bit.
Finally listened to Phil and got a scope.
And get in the seat time to learn engraving. And I mean, you know, the principles of it you can grasp fairly quickly, but you gotta put in the seat time
right.
in order to to really get good at
actually like learn how to do it. Yeah. And I think with like, you know, optimizers are great, but having like an actual microscope and seeing actually what you're doing, it helps you learn your mistakes faster, and it makes it easier to like correct those mistakes.
Absolutely.
I think even just like in general, having a scope for anything is really great, but especially when you're doing like micro work like engraving or stone setting.
Yep.
That's all for today's show. A huge thank you to Alicia Goodwin for joining the show today. If you'd like to learn more about Alicia and her instructional classes and podcasts, visit her website at www.linguanigra.com. We'd also like to thank today's sponsor, Lindstrom Tools. Lindstrom strives for perfection, delivering the high performance and long service life their customers have come to expect. Buy your Lindstrom tools today at www.riograndecom and use code Lindstrom1 to get 10% off all Lindstrom tools through the end of April. Do you have questions you would like answered on the show or want to submit ideas for future episodes? Email us at podcast@riograndecom. And don't forget to check out Tech Team Tuesday every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Mountain Standard Time on our YouTube and Facebook pages. Until next time, thank you for listening and have a great day.